Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing lawyers for global challenges.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. 1 year ago, Lehman Brothers was coming down. Wall Street was headed to its knees and taking the American economy with it. An astounded world watched as the U.S. financial system nearly imploded. In the months of massive bailout and massive loss that followed, everyone promised a change in the way Wall Street did business. This hour, On Point, 1 year after the fall of Lehman Brothers, what has and has not changed on Wall Street. Joining me first today from New York is Matthew Bishop, American business editor and New York bureau chief for The Economist magazine. His forthcoming book is The Road from Ruin, How to Renew Capitalism and Get America Back on Top. Matthew Bishop, thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be with you.
You remember all the promises. There would be enormous change. This would not happen again. Things would be different. Here we are 12 months later. In terms of regulation, how much has changed, Matthew?
Well, not a lot has changed at the moment. Partly that was inevitable. You've had a catastrophic disaster in the financial system, and basically the government had to throw everything it had at just stabilizing the system. So it was like the emergency room. You just had to pump in as much money as possible and keep the banking system alive. The real question now is whether we're going to get the kind of reforms of regulation that are needed to make sure we don't have another catastrophic accident a year or two down the line. And there, actually, it's not all that encouraging. The original Obama proposals earlier in the summer were half-hearted compared to what they ought to have been. There was already a sense that the money in Washington was starting to make the Congress people timid in terms of what they're willing to regulate. And now as the economy starts to recover, there's a real danger that with other pressing political issues like healthcare reform and the climate change on the agenda, that the politicians will decide, well, maybe the banking system's recovered, so therefore we don't need to make the changes. And that would be a tragedy, I think.
President Obama in New York today is saying it's time to wind down government involvement in the financial sector. Of course, that involvement is huge, given all the bailout slash investments that the U.S. Government made in these banks. If there were to be significant reform on the regulatory side, what would that be? What should American citizens who may have lost a lot of money in the last 12 months look for, Matthew?
Well, I think there's always going to be a government role in the financial system. I think the failure of Lehman Brothers and the catastrophe that followed it showed us all that there was a lot of people who talked about a free market system, but in fact it was a regulated market system, and the regulation wasn't done very well. And so the question now is, do we put in place a better regulatory system? I think you want to get the government out of ownership of the banks, which it has at the moment a large ownership stake in a number of the big banks, but you actually want to have a system of regulation that works. At the moment, the proposal is that many of the existing regulatory bodies, the CFTC and the SEC and so forth, will remain separate. At The Economist, we very strongly favor creating an integrated regulator, but it seems that all the congressmen want their own committees to keep their own pet regulators in place, and so that's not going to happen. Another big proposal is that there'll be a new body that protects consumer interests to make sure that consumers understand the financial products that they're being sold by the banks. That's coming under furious lobbying attack. As you can imagine, that's the last thing the banks want, is that actually the customers understand what they're being sold. Again, very short-sighted behavior by the banks, but who you'd think would actually want informed customers and long-term relationships with customers that weren't going to be borrowing too much and then flaming out like they did in the last couple of years. But the banks seem to be putting all their pressure and lobbying dollars into trying to stop that happening, which would be a pity.
Congress has said... Oh, I'm sorry, please go ahead. Yeah.
And then there's a sort of a desire to create more... more international coordination of regulators, which I think would be very important if that happens.
Congress has said it will act. I mean, there's been a plenty put on the table. Are we going to see a big conversation about this in Washington this fall, or are the tents just being folded on these initiatives?
Well, I think we will see a lot of talk about this, and the president's speech today, I think, is going to be triggering a lot of these conversations. The thing about financial regulation is so much of the power or the lack of power is in the details, and There's going to be all this lobbying activity. The banks clearly don't want to be heavily regulated, and congressmen receive a lot of money from the financial services industry, and they want to keep that money coming. So there's a real danger that the public interest will be lost in this process, particularly if the economy, as seems to be the case, the worst is over. And there'll just be this sense of, things may be getting better. Let's not upset the recovery by getting tough on the banks just as they're starting to lend again.
And what about on the sort of Wild West fringe of this, credit derivatives? We all learned a lot about those in a hurry last fall when the leverage on this very exotic lending threatened to turn everything upside down. But yet we see the activity on there is up substantially over a couple of 3 years ago. In this year, are there any lines being drawn here around the riskiness of what the banks can and are doing?
Well, I think we have to be careful here because I think the lessons of history, which I write about in my new book, Road from Ruin, which is coming out in a while. But the lesson of history is that you don't want to stop financial innovations like credit derivatives. You want to figure out how to use them properly. And they actually do provide, when they're used properly, better risk management in the system. The danger is that they're used in inappropriate ways, which is what happened over the last couple of years, where they allowed the banks to take far bigger risks than anyone had any right to take, and then left the taxpayer picking up the bill. And so it's much more about how do we ensure that the banking sector really has to face the consequences of the decisions it takes, that they, when they do take bad bets, they suffer the consequences, rather than trying to sort of micromanage the particular sorts of financial instruments that they invest in.
Though, I have to say, a year ago, an awful lot of people were ready to micromanage away from some of those extremes of risk that left so many damaged and hurt, even on the consequences side. Is there concrete movement?
Yeah, but the issue is, can you reduce risk in the system? How much should you reduce risk? And you can take huge risks with bonds and with equities. It doesn't need to be complex derivatives to take big risks. And the problem in the system was there was just far too much debt that was being invested by people who benefited a lot from the upside but didn't really face very severe consequences on the downside if their bets went wrong. And we have to figure out a way of changing the incentives in the financial system so that people don't feel that they can take these big bets, get very rich, but have nothing to worry about if it goes wrong. And that is very difficult, and that's what the debate should be focused on.
1 year later, that debate is still underway, and action really not taken. Matthew Bishop with The Economist magazine. Forthcoming book is The Road from Ruin, joining us from New York today, where the president, of course, has his big speech. Matthew, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Joining me now from Washington is Simon Johnson, former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. He's a professor at MIT's Sloan School of Management, senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, co-founder and blogger at the website baselinescenario.com. His article titled "The Next Financial Crisis, It's Coming, and We Just Made It Worse" appears in the September 23rd issue of The New Republic. Simon Johnson, welcome back to On Point.
Nice to be with you, Tom.
Give us your big take on where we stand a year later. I think there was such a sense of terror and outrage that few might have doubted a year ago or 10 months ago or half a year ago that there would be big change. Have we seen even marginal change?
We've certainly seen change, more than marginal change, but it's mostly change in the wrong direction. Look, the biggest banks have become bigger. The concentration of their economic power has increased and their political clout has increased. It's amazing. There was a moment, I think, when it could have gone differently. There was a moment when the banks were over a barrel and this administration in particular had an opportunity to really change things, but they let that moment slip. And as a result, the banks are more powerful on Capitol Hill. They have more what you might call mind control over official Washington than ever before. It's incredible. It's really, really scary.
You say worse could happen. Are you talking, I don't know, at the end of some new 20 or 30 year cycle? Or it was longer than that since the Great Depression. Could we have, decades of good times roll and then, yes, it will come again, but a half century down the road? Is that what you're talking about?
No, that's not my view. That's the official view, by the way. The official view, which you hear from Treasury and the National Economic Council in the White House, is, oh, we had an accident, a very rare, unfortunate accident, but only happens once a century, so don't worry, go back to your homes. We've got this under control. Absolutely not my view. My view is we've turned ourselves into something like an emerging market, a Russia or a Korea or an Argentina or a Brazil, countries that over the past 20 years, longer in some instances, have had repeated crises. So repeated crises means every 2, 3, 5 years, they go through a boom, bust, bailout cycle. And these cycles often get bigger for them, and I think the next one could well get bigger for us because of what's happened in the underlying structure. And this is incredibly expensive in terms of the cost to the taxpayer. It's really risky in terms of the things the Fed has to do. And by the way, even when things go relatively well in this avoidance of total collapse, a lot of people, a lot of poorer people in American society and elsewhere get absolutely hammered. The Great Depression was awful for 25 or 30% of American society. They had an absolutely terrible, terrible decade. But I think 10 to 15% of American society is going to have a really bad, at least half decade, as a direct result of what happened a year ago and all of the problems that led up to that, the problems of our financial structure, which we haven't fixed.
Simon Johnson, put what happened in the last year in the big picture that you see surrounding it for us, to give a little perspective on what you see having gone on here.
Well, I think you really want to go back 20 or 30 years and look at what's happened to the financial sector in this country. It's become huge. This is a sector that used to operate just fine. Actually, way back, it was 1 or 2% of our economy. 1 or 2% of GDP was in finance. It's a pretty well-run sector. It grew in the post-war period. Some of that growth was sensible. But after 1980, with financial deregulation, it became massive. It actually peaked. The latest data we have is that it was close to 8% of our economy went into financial services. Remember, you don't consume these or eat these financial services directly. They're supposed to help you do other things like move your savings into something productive, have it earn a decent return, then you can have the money back when you want it. 8% of our economy went into that. It's huge. And if you look at the profits they were making, in 2003, the financial sector made 40% of all corporate profits in the United States. They took a lot of that money and they plowed it back into lobbying. They took their economic power, turned it into political clout. And of course, Washington is a very, very open to this sort of thing always. And we got even more deregulation. We got big moves under the Clinton administration, even more moves under the Bush administrations. And as a result, the finance sector was able to do whatever it wanted. And what it wanted to do, what finance always wants to do everywhere in the world is they get the upside. You, the taxpayer, gets to pick up the bill when things go wrong. You get the downside. That's what they want, and that's what they got in the United States. I think, actually, on a bigger scale, both in dollar terms and as a percent of GDP, arguably, than we've ever seen a financial sector get away with on a sustained basis anywhere in the world.
There are a couple of sides to this. There's the regulatory backdrop and the loosening of that over time. There's also the bailout backdrop and the role that the Federal Reserve Bank and more have played on that side. We'll come to that. You see that as very fundamentally important. But on regulation, what have you seen happen in the 12 months since the Lehman collapse? What did you expect? Where do you see us standing right now? American citizens sort of lifting their head up today and saying, all right, that was pretty bad. What have we done in response, or what should we do? Where do we stand on that arc, Simon?
Well, it's pretty clear where we stand, which is we've done almost nothing. And if you look at the proposals been put forward by the administration, that they're very weak, except on one dimension, which is the Consumer Protection Agency, which is a good idea. And that's the only thing, interesting enough, that the banks have objected to anywhere in this process. They were allowed in on the design of the Obama proposals. They were fine with pretty much everything the administration wanted to do, which is basically nothing, except on consumer protection. And the banks really don't want informed consumers. Surprise, surprise. So they're fighting that one. And that's just the administration. When you get to Congress and you get to the various committees and you get to the amount of money that finance pumps into the political system that way, of course, you're going to get no progress at all. And even the Consumer Protection Agency, sadly, may founder on the rocks of the massive corporate contributions from the financial sector.
But more regulation has been proposed. I mean, what should people be watching? What might they be hammering their congressman on, saying, what about this? What about that? On what front do you see a vacuum or vacuums waiting to be filled?
Well, I think if you wanted to push for something, And to be honest, though, I do think it's a bit too late. I think the time to do this, really make an impact, was early this year when the banks were in a very, very weak position. They needed government money to survive. Now they're back on their feet. Now they've got their political wings are fully expanded again. It's a hard struggle. But I would stress three things. First of all, size. You know, CIT Group was a substantial financial enterprise that failed or was close to failure earlier in the summer. Total assets about $80 billion, okay, 80. Mm-hmm. And the Treasury took the view that it was okay to let them fail, and they've gone off and they've renegotiated with creditors. It's a messy process, but the world has not entered as a result. Now, the banks that got us into trouble, Lehman, Bear, and the other banks that were rescued, were $600 to $800 billion in assets or bigger. So in other words, if we could make the biggest financial institutions in this country smaller and push them down below $100 billion in assets, and there's various ways you could do that, that would make a big difference to system stability going forward. Not a panacea, but it would help. That's number one. Number two, the financial institutions need more equity. We used to operate our bank system with a lot more equity, and equity in banks is a cushion against losses. That's what the shareholders absorb before everybody turns around and starts looking expectantly at the taxpayer. We need to get a lot more equity. The government is going to tweak that. I think one of my colleagues is calling it a dinky proposal for raising equity. Well, I think it's about right. We need to go back to the kinds of equity we had in the bank system before 1935, actually. And thirdly and finally, I would stress the absolute importance of this revolving door between Wall Street and Washington. You can walk out of a troubled Wall Street firm, and the next Monday you're designing bailout packages in Washington, and you can walk out of a regulator in Washington, and the next Tuesday you are a key advisor to somebody who is, you know, playing in the space that you used to regulate. I think there should be a 5-year moratorium, and that's what I'm calling for, 5-year moratorium on moving these two ways in these decision roles that clearly have a conflict of interest and clearly shape people's incentives one way or the other.
How can it be, this is surely naive, but how can it be that after a scare this deep and pain this deep, these things are not happening? I mean, the whole country watched it. You know, almost everyone was hurt, and many people were hurt very, very badly. I mean, how can people get up in the morning and say, no, we're not doing this?
That's a good question, and you should ask them that question. My take is that it's really all about the power structure, and it's all about the how much power you have in the hands of the biggest financial institutions. So let's say the big 10, the big 15. Now, these guys were on the ropes 9 months ago. Mm. The government let them off. The government decided to bail them out or to rescue them, which was fine. I supported that. But to rescue them in a way that was very, very favorable to management of these big banks. If you contrast, for example, how the government treated General Motors, and remember, it actually forced Rick Wagoner, the CEO of General Motors, out as a requirement, actually.
Right.
Not based on it, by the way, not based, as I can see, on any statute or bailout law that says you can force out the CEO of General Motors. They just said, this guy is gone. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you're going to cut your product lines. You're going to become a smaller company because that's what we're going to support. They did not take that kind of proactive role with regard to finance. They said, oh my goodness, you are the financial experts. We've had an unfortunate accident. You go ahead and do what you want. We will support you all in this, and we'll provide mass amount of government support. That was a choice. That's the government strategy. And once they did that and the banks started to come back, then, of course, they became politically stronger, and they could resist. They can resist. They are resisting even what their friends, their close friends and allies in Treasury want to do, for example, on the new Consumer Protection Agency. You think they might show a little appreciation, a little deference to Secretary Geithner and at least go along with that one of his proposals that has some teeth. But no, they don't want any part of it. And they have massive deep pockets, Tom. And they are redoubling their lobbying efforts in Washington. They own this town.
The next financial crisis is the headline on your piece in the New Republic. You say it's coming and we just made it worse. What kind of scenario do you see or fear, and what kind of potential time frame?
Well, if you look back to what's happened since 1980, which is what we try and do in some detail in this article, you can see we've gone through repeated cycles where there's a run-up in something, in some asset price. You can call it a bubble or not, as your preference. Let's call it a speculative frenzy around something. Mm-hmm. And it goes too far, and there's a burst, there's a downturn, there's financial pressure. And the Fed, under Greenspan, a little bit under Volcker, to be honest, but the later Volcker, but definitely under Greenspan, the doctrine was we'll cut interest rates and help you guys out, and we'll refloat the financial part of the economy. This was called, after 1998, which was one iteration of this. It was called quite widely the Greenspan put, meaning that if your asset went down in price, you could sell it implicitly or to Alan Greenspan, or he would guarantee the price, so you wouldn't lose too much money. Mm-hmm. Now, the Greenspan put, combined with the way the Fed operates, and it can cut interest rates, it can provide financial support, has morphed into what we now are starting to call the Bernanke put. The Bernanke put is actually much bigger than the Greenspan put. And all of this means that if you're a big financial enterprise, you can take on massive risks. And assuming that other people follow along and you get enough of the entire financial system heading your direction, when things go bad, the downside can be handed off to the government. The taxpayer will bail you out, either directly through the budget and various kinds of budgetary actions, I would stress, are going to increase our total debt to GDP, the amount of debt outstanding held by the private sector, will roughly double, that's my personal opinion, from where it was before the crisis, 40% of GDP to 80% of GDP. And yes, that is your taxes down the road. Plus, the Fed put in all this money, all this credit, which may or may not turn out to have some complicating implications. And we're not done. We haven't fixed it. Next time around, if you give the Fed the choice, collapse or rescue, they'll do the rescue. They'll provide the Bernanke put. And the financial services industry knows this, and they're taking this. Of course, they take this into account. They're very smart people in how they place their bets and how they run their businesses. It's really asking for trouble.
Can we afford to do that again? If the debt is 80% of GDP or headed there by your calculation, maybe there just wouldn't be the means to bail them out again. Maybe the market ultimately, like nature, comes into play.
Well, ultimately there is, of course, a limit. How much we could do this remains to be seen. Japan, through a version of this that's played out differently, Japan's a very different society, has pushed its debt up close to 200% of GDP. Basically, what the whole setup here, the whole scam, if you like, is that financial services sector is taking advantage of the taxpayer, and they are using the taxing capacity or the future tax-raising ability of the American state to underwrite their own crazy activities. Now, eventually, the craziness will be controlled, or the taxpayer won't pay up, and we'll have a very big fiscal problem in this country. But it really comes down to that. Can the banking system rip us off to the degree that it causes national financial fiscal meltdown eventually?
Well, let's get a caller. Steve from Stowe, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Steve.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. So I've been listening to this, and I was thinking about the, I read recently in a book this description of the greatest bull market in history, when advances in communications technology made it possible for every American to participate in the stock market. Well, the book was written in 1923. It was talking about the crash of 1900, which was then followed by a huge real estate bubble and a huge crash in 1907 when all the liquidity dried up and, the market was almost completely destroyed. And then, of course, 22 years later was the crash of 1929. I mean, fundamentally, we've been here before. We've played this cycle out. And in the end, what it seems to come down to, because I'm an organizational consultant and I kind of see this behavior writ small and writ large with businesses, there's a cycle of innovation in the economy. When you have a cycle of innovation, it's easy for Wall Street to make money, because there's companies like, General Motors in the 20s, or IBM in the 60s, or more recently, of course, Microsoft and Cisco. And, it's easy when those companies are around. But when you pull the plug on the cycle of innovation, which happened in the 1920s under Hoover and happened under George Bush, then you don't keep feeding that new wave of innovative companies. At that point, Wall Street has to do something creative to make money. And what they do that's creative is that they essentially try to make money out of nothing, as we saw with all these credit swaps and derivatives and mortgage-backed securities, because fundamentally you've got a whole industry that is where your job, if you go to work in Wall Street, your job is to make money for somebody else. And if you don't do that, you're going to be fired, and they'll get someone else who can.
Steve, let us pick it up, because on the other hand, no country wants to, or economy wants to, drive off a cliff like gerbils again and again. Simon Johnson, what about Steve's analysis there? You go back to about the same period, but you put a little different gloss on it. How do you see these recurring cycles?
Well, I think this issue of cycles of innovation is a good one. And obviously, we need in this economy what I would call non-financial innovation. And we're actually very good at this. We had a lot of it in the 19th century when finance, by the way, was quite a small part of the economy. And we've had these great waves of it in U.S. history in the 20th century, including, by the way, after World War II, when the financial sector, the banking part of the financial sector, was quite tightly regulated and curtailed in what it could do, to their deep frustration. But that was a period when we invented computers. We completely changed began to completely change telecommunications infrastructure and much of the other ways that the sort of retail and other things were organized in this country. Mm. And we introduced venture capital, which is, I think, the biggest financial innovation of the last 150 years anywhere in the world, actually. All of that was done with a very constrained financial system. And I think the problem, and what Steve was getting at, is that there is a tension between financial innovation and non-financial innovation. And it is a mistake to think that financial innovation is kind of like non-financial innovation and kind of good, probably in the same way, generally, that non-financial innovation is good. It's not good. It's actually very, very dangerous. Yes, you can find instances where financial innovations have helped. The ATM, very good. Mm. Credit cards, terrific. Those are old financial innovations. Since 1975, what are the big financial innovations that have really helped the non-financial part of the economy? People struggle to find anything significant. If you find anything, it's small, and it comes with this massive downside risk that is handed off to the taxpayer, we now see, and we see this in repeated iterations. So I think you want the financial sector to become much more controlled in order that the non-financial part of the economy remains dynamic and enterprising. I'm a professor of entrepreneurship at MIT. This is what I work on for the U.S. and around the world. The entrepreneurs, the non-financial entrepreneurs, are severely hampered and hindered by our financial sector right now because their taxes are going up and their future taxes are going to be even higher because of the crazy things that have gone on in the banks.
But how do you get back to that? I mean, it sounds so far from where we are now. The Federal Reserve has been at work, is stepping in these cycles since early in the last century. How do you, you know, where's the reverse on this? If in fact we need to get out of that cycle of bust and bailout.
Well, there's also a political cycle, Tom, a historical one. Finance has a tendency to get big and get dangerous in the United States, and this partly because we're an innovative, open society. And there's been confrontations between political power and excessive, overweening banking power at least three times before in U.S. history. One was in the 1830s, Andrew Jackson against the Second Bank of the United States. Second one was in the early 1900s, Teddy Roosevelt against the trusts. And the trusts were, of course, very much had a very strong financial component. J.P. Morgan was a big player in those. And then, of course, there's the aftermath of the Great Crash and FDR re-regulating the financial system. So each one of these times, political power has actually prevailed. Democratic political power, anti-banking power has prevailed. And we didn't, in any of those instances, lose our long-term, lose our productivity growth or lose our innovative capacity. So I think what you need to do is look at those historical episodes, update, obviously, because the world is different. And by the way, the financial sector now is a much bigger chunk of the economy than it was even in 1929, 1935. It's probably four times the size that it was then. And so, and it's much, much more clever, much more devious, and much more sophisticated politically. You have to update, but you basically have to re-regulate. You have to go back to a tight system of financial regulation across the board, which, of course, the financial industry will absolutely hate, but that's the point.
Simon, let's take calls. We have a lot of people waiting to get on. Oakland, Iowa. Carl, you're on the air, Carl.
Yes, sir. I find that there are two people in Congress who have enabled both the recent crashes in the markets and in the banking system, including some complicity in the savings and loan crises. And they are guiding the legislation that will come out of any of this. They're Frank in the House of Representatives and Chris Dodd in the Senate. And then the person who has to sign these legislation, whatever it is that may come out, is the one who immediately following the Iowa caucuses reaped in just huge bonanza of contributions. True enough, some of it came from just ordinary citizens excited about a new face and a new message, but it was also very heavily financed by the Wall Streeters who turned away from Hillary and put their betting money on Obama.
Carl, so you're laying it all on Democrats, even though we had years of Republican-led deregulation?
No, I'm saying there will be no significant legislation that will affect anything in a positive fashion like Mr. Johnson is suggesting. Mm. As long as we have that triumvirate running the economy, their hands are dirty and bloody for a lot of the things that have gone on in the last couple of years.
Carl, you're naming names, and let us take them to Simon Johnson. Simon, what about the, Carl in Iowa calls out Chris Dodd and Barney Frank and Barack Obama. I mean, bring it right down to people and political leverage points. How do you see what's going on in terms of specific politicians and their power?
Well, I think Carl's right to look at the individuals and look at their track records, and none of their records are particularly impressive on this point. I think that the problems are deeper. I think if you look at all the committee members on the House and the Senate side, the relevant committees, they're all taking contributions from the financial sector. I think Chris Dodd feels vulnerable because of his personal circumstances, and it may actually move towards more of a reformist stance. We'll see. As I said, the only thing really on the table is the consumer that's worth anything is the Consumer Protection Agency. So how he takes that up remains to be seen. Barney Frank, I think, is sympathetic to that. I wish that he were pushing harder on the other dimensions. He actually has an enormous amount of experience and clout and really could move the consensus. But he's hesitating. There's no question. And as for the administration, well, it's the contributions and, of course, it's the personnel. Most of the people at Treasury and in the White House running the bailout and the re-regulation writ large are people who are very, very close to the financial sector. Not absolutely everyone, but almost all of them. And they don't want to rock the boat too much. They, perhaps they're genuinely fearful of doing that. But, of course, nobody's asking them to take precipitate action. Now the economy begins to come back a little bit. Now's the time to put in place a proper plan that over the next 1, 2, 3 years would really lead to much tighter regulation and help the non-financial sector recover. But that's not how this year.
Pull the lens back even further. Look at Republicans, Democrats. I mean, where do you see the weight of things having gotten out of kilter here between the influence of these two parties over the last couple of decades?
Well, obviously, the big changes happened in the 1980s, and it's part of the Reagan deregulation revolution. And I must say I'm in favor. I support some of the aspects of deregulation. I like cheap air travel, for example. That's good. But what happened in the financial sector is different. Finance is not the same as non-financial activities. People have to remember this, because when things go bad, the financial sector can say, oops, we screwed up. We're about to, lose a massive amount of money. Do you want the bank system to collapse, or are you going to give us a bailout? No other sector in this economy or any other economy can say that on the same massive scale. So finance got deregulated. Finance started to get out of control in the 80s. But, of course, it was the Clinton administration, particularly the people around Robert Rubin, who, of course, former Goldman Sachs person, then left government to go to Citigroup. These people really believed that what was good for Wall Street was good for the rest of the economy, and that more deregulation was the way to go. It was a mistake. It was a colossal mistake. It was a huge mistake. And it was facilitated by Alan Greenspan, who, of course, is coming from the Republican side, but got on very, very well with the Clinton Democrats, too. Alan Greenspan was in 2000 or 2005 called, regarded as one of the greatest central bankers ever. He wasn't, okay? You look back, you look at what was done, he was one of the worst central bankers we've ever seen in this country or in any other major industrialized country. It was a disaster what happened under his auspices.
A disaster because it built this expectation that the big gamblers would be supported, would be ultimately bailed out.
Exactly, Tom. See, when you evaluate how a financial system does, whether it helps growth or whether it hurts regular companies, regular people, you can't take a 1, 2, or 5 year horizon. You have to look over 10, 20 years. And, Greenspan was in. Greenspan oversaw the whole thing. Greenspan's philosophy was, don't worry about financial speculative frenzies. We'll just clean up afterwards. Well, that turns out to be exactly the wrong strategy. And the Federal Reserve has to get away from that now. Ben Bernanke did well once the choice was collapse versus rescue. The question is, and his legacy, I think, is going to be determined by whether he takes steps now to reduce the probability of collapse, reduce the amount of damage done by future financial collapse. At the moment, there is nothing we can see on the table in front of him, being pushed by him, that would move us in that direction.
Because the Fed has stepped in so many times before, but it's always the same problem. If they don't step in, the risk is collapse and everybody's held hostage to it.
Absolutely. And you need to go back. If you go back to the origins of the Fed, you go back to the debate that happened after the 1907 crisis. There was a National Monetary Commission, which was run by Senator Nelson Aldrich, which was pushing more of the banking view. And there was something called the Peugeot Committee that was looking more at a populist view. Louis Brandeis made himself very famous, even more famous than he was already, with a book called Other People's Money and How the Bankers Use It. So everybody from the left and the right was pushing at this, and they came up with this compromise, sort of a Woodrow Wilson compromise of the way the Federal Reserve is structured, basically as a bailout mechanism, as a way to support the financial system when it gets into trouble. And what, of course, they found in the 1920s, took a while to make this clear, was that this was actually no better than what they had in the 19th century, maybe even worse. All right. But then they added regulation. They really tightened regulation in the 1930s. And the way the Fed operates in a regulated, tightly regulated financial system is okay. We had good growth and great innovation in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Mm. And then they took away the regulation. And now you have the Fed bailout mechanism without the regulation. And what do you know? It's back to the roller coaster of the pre-Fed period and then the initial Fed period, the 1920s. And we are going to run that and rerun it until we tighten up the regulation or until we bankrupt ourselves.
Let's get a call from Eliza in Boston. Eliza, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm getting back to a previous caller's comment and something that your guest mentioned early on, which is the ability of the financial industry to basically pay off Congress. And, of course, this is affecting any number of areas of military contractors, pharmaceuticals, mm-hmm. healthcare, mm-hmm. any number of big debates that are happening in our society right now. And I'm curious about your guest's ideas about effective lobbying and campaign finance reform that really keep us from always socializing the losses and privatizing the profit. This is what these people are interested in. And as long as our representatives continue to be able to take huge sums of money from these people, it will influence their decision-making.
Heads I win, tails you lose dynamic that we just saw reenacted in this last year that we're looking at today. Simon,
exactly.
You hear Eliza's question. It's sort of the question of any American voter, I think. How do you get away from this?
Well, I think you have to amend the Constitution, Tom, seeing as you asked the question, which is not a undertaking I recommend lightly. But the Supreme Court seems to have taken the view that campaign finance reform is infringing free speech. We've seen this before in American history when the Supreme Court doesn't feel that a reformist kind of agenda fits in the existing constitutional framework. This was a huge fight, as you may know, over 100 years ago around the income tax, whether you could have a federal income tax. And ultimately, it had to go to a constitutional amendment. I'm not saying it's super likely. I'm not saying it's an easy, quick thing.
About campaign finance on that particular front?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the issue is whether corporations can be regarded as individuals mm-hmm. and whether corporate free
rights.
Speech and corporate contribution, is exactly the same as individuals. And I think this obviously fits into a broader context of whether very, very rich individuals should be allowed to tilt things their way, which was also, that is a recurrent theme in American politics, as you well know. So these issues have to be addressed at that level. And it has to be we have to have campaign finance reform ultimately to underpin this. I think that is some ways off.
Let's go to Ruth in Bamberg, South Carolina. We're talking constitutional amendment to fix this. What are you seeing, Ruth?
Hi, Tom. I fully agree with Senator Johnson. This deregulation has really put so much power into the financial sector. And they didn't learn from the savings and loan crisis. We had that this mm-hmm. crisis they're going through right now is that magnified. And the credit card companies, instead of helping people after all this stimulus and bailout, they're sending out letters to people, changing all their rates, raising them all, changing the pay times. Banks are adding on extra charges instead of them putting money into the public for companies that need daily cash capital. They're denying them and causing them to go out of business. They have totally failed to give back to the public what the public gave to them in their time of need. And I truly disagree with ever giving them that kind of money, because they don't know how to think of other people. They're strictly looking for what they can get out of everything all the time.
Ruth, thanks for your perspective. Simon, you've said one way to get the attention of the banks would be to put the skin of their managers and directors back in the game, that the board members and top managers should be personally liable for losses if their banks fail. Would that sort of come around to an answer to some of Ruth's complaint there ultimately?
Well, I don't think that necessarily would be a panacea, but it certainly would help. But it has to be a lot of skin. It has to be back to where we were in the 19th century, where basically if you ran a bank that failed, you were done. You know, personally, you were ruined, and socially and professionally, you were absolutely ruined. I mean, right now we have CEOs who own, may own some significant number of shares, but it's a small part of their total wealth. And if something goes bad, they go from being a multi-billionaire to being, you know, something of a millionaire. They don't really care, okay? And then they start a new hedge fund, right? Or a financial advisory service company of some kind. That's just not acceptable.
Just an example that Richard Parsons, chair of Citigroup since February this year, estimated to be worth about $100 million, reports he owns only about $750,000 worth of Citi stock. I mean, his skin is barely in the game.
That's right. And of course, you have to worry about that, because this Citigroup is a very big, complicated operation. People are divided about how easy it is to oversee it and to manage it and to manage the risks. If it were to have a problem, or should say further problems, that would be a definite issue for the taxpayer. And you need the executives to really care about this. It could well be that breaking up Citigroup is the way to go. But and surely, if they feel that they have real skin in the game, which is this Wall Street expression, if they feel that they've got something to lose, they're going to be more careful. That is how the world works, and that is how they see the world. And yet we let them get away with this very kind of lackadaisical attitude. And I'm sure Mr. Parsons may be a great manager, but the problem is way beyond him. It's much broader. It's everybody has these kinds of distorted incentives.
Let's get a call from Detroit. Robin, you're on the air with Simon Johnson.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
Enjoying your show. Very interesting topic. What I'd like to say and hear spoken to is this. I think it's inevitable that these corporate interests are going to keep on wanting to have their say and are going to find a way to have their say, just the same as water runs downhill. They'll get around whatever obstacles you put in the way of finance reform and so on. It seems to me that it's a dead end to take that approach, and that really what we need is for the unions in this country to form a workers' party, a flat-out workers' party for all working people, not just unions, that will really have the same kind of weight in the political arena, that you can't fight this by constitutional amendments or finance reform. You need to slug it out politically, is my view, and I'd really like to hear that spoken to, because I think this whole getting caught up in all the ins and outs of finance reform and so on, or a constitutional amendment, how are you going to stop rich individuals without infringing free speech? Let them say what they have to say and slug it out with them.
Get your own megaphone. Robin, we've got it. Simon Johnson, how about it? It comes down to power, so it's a democracy. Organize, put the workers in a powerful position.
Well, I'm not opposed, Tom, to people at the lower end, to people who've done less well, organizing and finding a voice. And of course, that is what the Obama campaign was understood to be. I voted for the president, and I understood that the change was coming. And I'm struggling to see the change. What I'm seeing is a lot of reluctance to push for change on the part of the administration, a lot of excessive deference to corporate interests, in my opinion, around the financial issues, but also more broadly. I think, the caller is right, that it is a political – you need a political slugfest. You need an argument. You need to push really hard against these vested interests. And I would, you know, do it in various political arenas. I think you could do it within the Democratic Party just as effectively as creating new parties, perhaps more effectively given what we've seen in American history.
But won't the economy always be held hostage? I mean, even now people are saying, look, we had to do this just the way we've done it to get back on an even key. We narrowly avoided another depression. Don't mess with this. You know, we're getting back on an even keel here. Don't muck it up with all this, rowdy talk about a political slugfest.
Well, that is what the financial sector wants you to believe, Tom. And you have to remember, these are very sophisticated, smart people. Their message is not, give us the money or we'll shoot you. Their message is, well, you know, give us the money or not. It's your choice. But I should tell you, if you don't give us the money, that we will collapse and there will be the biggest depression in world history. Okay, That is the message. That is how they structured it. That was the choice that we faced a year ago, and it was the choice, and that was how it was framed to the Obama administration when they came in January. Don't do it again. Change the structures. Prevent them from being able to say that and threaten you in the same way again.
MIT's Simon Johnson, former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. See his blog at baselinescenario.com. Simon Johnson, it's always eye and ear opening to have you with us. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.